Hello and welcome to Building the Athlete with Scott Benson. I'm your host, Hall of Fame athlete, Hall of Fame coach, and sports performance expert. On today's show, we're going to be talking a lot about the NCAA with recruiting, with the new regulations and NIL money. It has been a game changer, and I don't think things will ever be the same from a recruiting perspective. So we got a lot of digging to do today. We've got James Hall, who's deputy athletic director with New Mexico State University. He'll be coming to us with all the information. He's got his thumb on the pulse of it. For my listening audience, if you are listening live in New York City, we've got an offer for you today. Go to bensonsportstraining.com. There'll be a pop-up, enter your name and email address, and we will send you a free sports nutrition ebook. Again, a free sports nutrition ebook just for going to bensonsportstraining.com. There'll be a pop-up, enter your information, and we will send that book to you. Welcome to Building the Athlete. I'm your host, Scott Benson. Today with me is James Hall, Deputy Athletic Director at New Mexico State University. James has been there for just under 20 years and spent 10 years prior to that at Ohio State University as an athletic academic counselor. James was a teammate of mine at Iowa State University. He was an All-American 800-meter runner and a team captain. James, welcome to the show today. Go ahead and just fill in any gaps that I missed on the intro.
Well, it's always good to see your face, and if I can't be with you physically, it's good to just see you and know you're doing well, so appreciate the invitation. Yeah, when you talk about that intro, you say, wow, 20 years at New Mexico State. I was 10 years at The Ohio State University before we had our run of Big Eight championships at Iowa State University back in the day, so a lot of time has passed on, but it's been great. I've been in the field of intercollegiate athletics my entire career, and it's been great. And also, you know, family has grown. I'd be remiss without saying that.
Real quick, you know, you mentioned we used to win a lot of Big Eight championships. A lot of our listening audience might not even know what the Big Eight is. So we should probably give everybody a rundown on that awesome conference we used to compete in.
Well, I guess I was thinking everybody understands the Big Eight, which is now the Big 12, which is obviously rotated multiple times. I don't think so. I was there at Iowa State from 87 to 91. And yeah, we were the old school Big Eight, which was tremendously great. They just added the Texas teams, but you know, we would have put something on them too, so it wouldn't have mattered.
So James, you've been at New Mexico State coming up on 20 years. I follow you on social media, and one thing that I see you always talking about is the academic success of your athletes. I believe, and I don't know if it's coincidental, for the last 20 years, your men's and women's teams have averaged or maintained a 3.0 GPA or higher. I know you have a passionate relationship with this part. Tell me why you're so into that. And I mean, obviously, I understand that the academic success is important, but you seem to go above and beyond with it. Why is that?
Well, I think for a couple of reasons. Number one, I was one of them, right? Or I would even take it further. I mean, I like to tell people I was an athlete student before I became a student athlete because I struggled academically. I was actually a non-qualifier coming out of high school. I did only scored an 11 on my ACT, and so I was not eligible to get in. But I was highly talented coming out of high school. At last meet, I ran one of the third fastest 800 foot in the country, so I was included. Arizona State, Iowa State, and so I was ready to roll, but couldn't get in because of the academic element the first semester. Fortunate enough, our coach Mergen stuck with me, and I was able to get into Iowa State spring of 87. And the rest, they say, probably is history. And so maybe that's the first reason, because of my own personal history. I understand what a lot of these young men and women go through, number one. Number two, I know the dreams and desire they have to be the best. And so you want to encourage them to do that, because following up, they're going to have to do that for the next 40 or 50 years of their life, because, you know, IBM doesn't have a football team. You know, Volkswagen, they don't have a basketball team. You're not going to be playing for them. You're going to be working for them. And I think the most important thing is those young men and women are somebody else's child. And I would hope that someone takes care of them. I know that's what the parents think, as I would want them to take care of our children. And so you're certainly passionate about it on that end, and you give them all you have because you know this is the most important developmental stages of their life. This is why I say the young ladies become women and the boys become men. Now, it takes us boys a little bit longer to become men. We just want to continue to have fun. That's to answer that why and that passion.
Back in the day, non-qualified, that was Prop 48. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay, so this just seems like a good bit of information to get out there. Is there still something similar to that for incoming freshmen?
Yeah, it is. I mean, everybody's got to go to the clearinghouse and they've got to become a final qualifier based on their cumulative, their GPA from high school on their core courses, the 16 core courses, as well as the test score. And does that equate to what they need to do to become a final qualifier? So that still exists. But again, resources have been better. Students have become better. Technology has been there. Some folks with learning disabilities have been able to help assist them moving forward. I mean, I didn't have any of those issues. I was just at LAZY and caught up with me real quick. And so those standards are still in place as it relates to your 16 core and your GPA. I have to make sure that they are equivalent so that you can move forward and be a final qualifier. And the test score has shifted post-COVID because they don't even look to require a lot of that anymore because of some of the limitations that that had. Now, it still is good. The test score is still good for academic scholarships, but from a final qualification, that has shifted.
Tell me, for parents listening, what are those requirements? What do you have to do to become eligible to be an NCAA athlete?
It's the math. It's the English. It's the science. It's the natural sciences. And, you know, those are your major core areas, and then you have a few more that you can substitute in there to get your 16 core courses, and a minimum of a 2.3 GPA helps you, you know, mix in between those elements. And again, that has become so standard now for high schools that usually is not the issue of meeting final qualification status. It's whether you're going to get into a particular institution because they may be open enrollment. They could be selective or they could be competitive. Those are the three areas that you're really looking at. I mean, if you're going to Ivy League, they're going to be extremely competitive, right? If you look at New Mexico State, we're selective. We're between that. We were open enrollment. Now we're a little bit selective. I mean, most schools are going to take about 75% to 80% of the applicants that they receive, right? But then you have those top. I was looking at a social media feed the other day, those top other programs like the UCLA's, the Harvard's, the Penn's, although that they have, you know, the Michigan's even have a boatload of applications. They're not taking everybody. They're going to be extremely competitive. And so that's what you're going to look at. Now, if you're a student athlete, depending on when you lie, you may be able to get in with some special admits because they'll have a few slots they'll have available for those athletic departments. But that certainly doesn't seem to be as much of a topic of issue as it used to be.
And then my understanding is the ACT scores and how you can rate those has changed as well as far as the super score.
Right. I mean, all of those elements, like I said, have changed, but that is so relatable to academic scholarships, right? Because if you hit certain metrics on your ACT or SAT score, then that's going to help you get academic financial aid, which is some folks will have to have because, again, with the roster limits and college athletics now, although it's a positive in terms of now you can get full scholarships. For instance, football is at 85 and now they're at 105. The question is, can you afford it? If you can't afford it, now you're kind of looking at some academic elements for these individuals. But again, there's another caveat that comes in. Even if you're academic, the problem is, you know, you're looking at can we have walk-ons like we used to? And that answer is no, because now everybody is full scholarship and the competitive level is so much higher. But going back to what you said, that ACT, SAT, I think is always important for you to make sure that you stay on top of that to garner as much academic money as you can, because you never know, that athletic opportunity may not present itself at that initial institution you go to, or you may transfer to another institution, decide you don't want to play or participate anymore, but you've got the academic scholarship to help minimize a lot of that debt once you graduate.
So is there not a minimum score that an incoming freshman has to attain on the ACT or SAT?
it's gone now. It's, again, it's shifted to now your core, right? And what, and the GPA that you get in your core, that's what you're determining your final qualification.
Tell me a little bit about your time at Ohio State, just being at a huge football school like that. That had to been, number one, a lot different than what school that you're at now. Just tell me a little bit, how were things different?
Yeah, you know, I went to Ohio State and I was like, I don't think it's really a big deal. You know, it's the same I've ever seen before. But yeah, it was beyond impressive. I think the first thing you learn at Ohio State is what they stand for. And it's people, excellence, and tradition. You learn that right off the gate, right? And then you meet people that are just absolutely phenomenal professionals and individuals. And the first person I think of is Archie Griffin. I met him and I'm like, oh my God, I'm gonna be a two-time Heisman Trophy winner. You know, he, you know, knew I was an academic advisor and just treated me like I had been there 10 years. And you're talking about one of the most upstanding individuals you ever meet, you know, that's Archie Griffin. There's no doubt. The second thing that you notice is the tradition of what they want to do, right? And you're like, man, it's at an extremely high level, and it goes really deep, and very committed, you know, to that element all the way back. You know, you learn about the Woody Hayes and those elements, right? And who played basketball, the Havlicek's at Ohio State, and always at that time, I think Jimmy Jackson had just finished and he was with the Dallas Mavericks. And you see all these professional athletes coming out, the Joy Galloways, the Sean Springs, Orlando Pings. That was the years I was there. You're just like, wow, this is just unbelievable. And being a college athlete myself, it was nice to kind of match yourself up against them to see what, you know, how you compare. So that was just the tradition. Right. And the one thing they always looked at was excellence. You're going to be excellent at what you do. So every day you went to work, you know, you had to be damn good at what you did. And you tried to figure out, how can I put my finger on the pulse? How can I be on the cutting edge? How can I be better than yesterday? Because you knew everybody was coming after you. And so those are the three things that stuck out. And I still have great relationships with student athletes. Like I said, Sean Springs was the president of Majority One program. That was what I instituted actually at Iowa State. It was a program designed to create a balance between academics and athletics, particularly for minority student athletes at predominantly white institutions. And Sean Springs was the first president of the program at Ohio State. And then we created the Sean Springs Majority One Postgraduate Scholarship. It was he had endowed $100,000, and that was the most money any student athlete had provided to Ohio State at that time in April of 2002. So I had some great memories there. Still talk to some individuals, Kevin Griffin, who's there, who's Archie's nephew. He's up in executive administrative role at Ohio State. And so that part's been good, and it teaches you a lot, again, about the people, tradition, and excellence.
Great. So we're kind of working backwards here. We've gone from New Mexico State to Ohio State. And then let's talk a little bit about Iowa State. You were there from 87 to 91. We were teammates there. Had a very unique dynamic. We had a team that was highly successful. We had Olympians, NCAA champions, All-Americans. We had it all. We were, I believe at the time, for the majority of the time, we were for sure ranked in the top 10 NCAA. And I know there's some years we cracked into the top five. We had crazy talented athletes. But I think a lot of our success came from that unique dynamic that we had, which has carried on for 30 years, 35 years, where all of us are still friends and still talk. In today's day and age, and we need to start unpacking the NIL and the new regulations and everything, how does that play out differently if we're on a highly successful NCAA team, we're all getting paid? How does it change that dynamic?
Well, it changes the dynamics drastically. When I hear you talk about Iowa State, I just smile, right? Because it was just such a great time and moment of my life that I continue to cherish, not only with the friendships and the teammates and how we grew as young men and Coach Bergen, bless his heart, and what he instilled in us as moving forward, as building upon being everyday champions, right? And we had a sense of not only belongingness, but togetherness that you can't pay for. And before I get into NIL, I think the biggest thing that I really take from that, it's about relationships, right? I say it's all about relationships. And my acronym for relationships is rapport, everyone links, and trust in one's narrative story and historical individual parallel systematically. And we can do a whole podcast on relationships, but you know, it's the rapport, right, that we had that was just unbelievable. And I don't even know if we knew how special it was back then. We just, that's just who we were. That's what we did. And we came from all different cultures and backgrounds. And don't get me wrong, we had our down times, but we had many more up times. And that's why I think we won championships, because we had other programs like Nebraska, who I thought had more talent than we did, but we were a better team. And that's what pushed us over the edge at times. We have people win that you didn't expect to win because we were a team. And so I think that part has different, that's the different part. And I don't think you're ever going to see that again, because young men and women, particularly in the sport of football and men's and women's basketball, it's a 9-month process. They're coming in, they're signing the deals, they're playing for that 1 year. You see it, they're old and staying old, so they only have 1 year remaining, or they have maybe two, and then they're gone. And so they don't have the ability to be together 3 and 4 and sometimes 5 years to be able to create that cohesiveness and that camaraderie.
So I think, you know, one thing that's got to be very, very different now is when you have young men and women making big people money and more in a lot of cases, how have you seen that affect interaction with the team, interaction with the coaches? Just the whole approach has got to be changed.
There is absolutely no doubt. I call it the NIL transactional marketplace, because that's what it is. And our student athletes now are their own business entities. And so they are looking at how they can invest, how they can become better entrepreneurs, how they can stretch the dollars that they had from maybe even a generational wealth standpoint for some of them. Now, again, I've always been a proponent of the transfer portal and the NIL and student athletes getting monetized and compensated for their name, image, and likeness. I think the thing that shocked me, I thought we were maybe talking about, you know, thousands of dollars, not hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars. I think someone put an arbitrary number out there, created an unrealistic fair market value, and now here we're talking about private equity firms becoming part of conferences and schools. We're talking about the insurance where student athletes are getting insurances now for, if you remember, Michael Jordan got insurance on his hands, right? You're looking at those things starting to play a factor. Commercial trademarks, the grants of rights extension, publicity rights, all of these things are beginning to impact how student athletes are looking at themselves as business entities, where that was not something that we looked at all. Now, on average, are folks making millions of dollars? No, they're not. But you really start to talk about football and men's and women's basketball, and I'll give you some numbers here, you know, Power Four. Those folks, and don't get me wrong, this is good money, but they're probably making on average about $5,500 to maybe $8,500 a month, right? So you're, you know, for those 8-9 months, it could be longer. I mean, it could be anywhere from $50,000 to $75,000, right? Which is a lot of money for football. Basketball is going to be a little bit higher because you have fewer people on the teams to share that. And that's that notoriety that they have is going to be extended. And then you've got women's basketball, which is going to be slightly different. Now, this is on average, you know, they're probably making, you know, the top end, you know, 15 to 20,000 for the year, maybe more. Again, when you get into these big time programs, now you could probably quadruple that, but I'm just giving you the app.
Okay. So you talk about an incoming freshman, you need to start looking at things more as an entrepreneur. You'd referred to them as a business entity. So if we have two athletes, ability is roughly the same, academics roughly the same, one of them has 1 million viewers on Twitter or X or whatever it is now, is that more valuable to New Mexico State in making a decision?
I think it's a factor, but it's not the factor, to be honest with you, because like anybody else, they'll tell you, James could have 1 million followers, but can he get the ball in the end zone? Can he get the ball in the basket? Can he run conference record times? Because that's what I'm concerned about. And here's how you can understand why a coach looks at that. For me, I'm an exempt employee, so this is a lifestyle that I've been able to live. for coaches, it's their livelihood. If things don't turn over in 2 and 3 years now, they're going to be looking to be replaced. And so I understand that you can have as many followers as you want, but what does that equate to in regards to productivity?
So it's a factor, but not a, you're not going to get a position over somebody else because you've got a big social media presence.
No, that's what add to your profile if you have the ability to be that starting high level first team conference running back, quarterback, receiver, etc. Then those follow that what you, your portfolio will request more based on where you position yourself from a performance standpoint.
Where does that money come from? If somebody's getting paid $8,500 a month, where is that coming from?
Well, I like to say the student athlete has now become a competitor for all athletic programs. And what I mean by that, because everybody has their fundraising arm, right? Which is, your fundraising development area. Then most programs are going to have their sports-specific club accounts, right? So you have that. And then you have your multimedia rights partner, that's at Learfield or a Van Wagner. Well, now you have student athletes and their own business entity. That's where they fit at now. So all of those dollars you were going after is now real money that has to be attributed to student athletes' payroll now. So that though the monies are going to come from those areas, but also, you can package a student athlete from a situational piece of Alston money, academic money, if you have that at your institution. For the Alston case, you can also look at individuals who qualify for Pell Grant. That helps. Now, this is all rev share, right? So this is where some of those dollars can come from. And then NIL packaging that you can do that also helps go towards that rev share. And then the last part is if you're increasing your scholarship dollars, meaning if you go from 85 scholarships to, let's just say, 95, those 10 scholarships can count towards rev share. So that's where you're getting it from. But again, that's why you see the private equity firms looking to get into the business. That's why you see the gentleman, Cody Campbell, who's the chair of the Board of Regents at Texas Tech, who's a billionaire. He's gotten involved now and he's funding Texas Tech. So you're looking at people who are literally becoming external partners and investors of your university and athletic club.
I feel like I read something about Texas Tech. Maybe it was a different school, but there was a private donor that was giving $50 million just for football. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that definitely sounds right. And I think he gave almost about $300 million is what he gave. I mean, he had an oil business. He sold it for, I think, $4.2 billion, him and a couple other partners. And they're reinvesting that dollars into Texas Tech athletics, in particular football. I think their defensive line or their skills at Texas Tech, I think their NIL just for those in individuals about $7 million. I know Florida State a couple of years ago, I think their defensive line tallied about $12 million just in NIL for that particular unit. So yeah, these are real dollars that you're trying to make sure that you get a return on that investment though.
So for smaller schools, it's going to get real hard to compete if you don't have that type of money coming in?
I would say yes and no, because we're not going after those individuals because they weren't coming to the Mexico States of the world to begin with, right? And there's not enough scholarships at this point, even with the roster limits expanding, because people can't really afford that additional dollar. There's still more high-level performing interscholastic athletes out there than there are scholarships to get. So we're not competing with those individuals, example, for Texas Tech anyway. It's all relative and it's scalable to your institution and to your comp.
So are these athletes, let's just say I'm a men's basketball player, I'm making $8,500 a month. Is that W-2 wage or is it 1099?
Well, I can tell you what it is going to be tax implications if you don't look at both of them, because that's the one thing I think you'll begin to see more coming out is, you know, after 2 or 3 years that people start to figure out what were actuals and then what was projected. And here's what I mean, because these contracts that these student athletes are signing and these agreements and these conditions are private, right? Nobody really, really knows what they're making, right? Because you really end up impact a couple of things. You impact the locker room because now Scott's making more than James, number one. Number two, you start, the public starts figuring out what people are making and they're not happy. And number three, it starts impacting recruiting. So right now, all of those contracts are confidential. And so you don't know how much they're making. But as that unfolds, that's where the tax implications can be an issue. So that's why you need to make sure you have good business managers, business advisors, people who are helping you track them.
And that's why I was curious, you know, if it's W-2 income, at least taxes are being taken out of the money. My guess is they're an independent contractor when it comes to NIL. So it's probably, they're probably paid on a 1099, which they're responsible for paying their taxes. Do institutions, is there anybody there to help these kids be fiscally responsible?
Absolutely. That's what we do from a student athlete welfare standpoint. You know, we've created a class and we really have modules and information that we can disseminate to our student athletes. We work with them when they have questions. You've got your compliance office. That's why bringing it in-house has really helped the individuals with financial literacy. But again, I think this is more, it goes beyond financial literacy. It's what you talk about. This is not just about opening a checking account and opening a savings and investment. Some of these folks are talking generational wealth. You have to understand, again, the W-2s and the 1099s. What are you needing to take out? What do you want to invest in, right? Because, you know, just because you think it's a good idea, that may not be the best route you want to take and you need to pivot. We have all these conversations, have workshops and seminars throughout the course of the year for our student athletes so that they understand the global aspect of financial literacy.
Do you have, or maybe not just necessarily New Mexico State, but NCAA as a whole, are non-revenue sports, they're still getting paid, is my understanding. I mean, obviously it's going to be scalable, but I've heard some stories about non-revenue athletes still getting pretty good chunks of money.
Yeah, and again, that's all relative to what conference and school you're in and what you bring in revenue. If you've opted in, then that could be upwards of $22.5 million of rev share. And the student athletes, that money will trickle down. Obviously, between football and men's basketball, they probably generate 90% of those dollars, right? So that the remaining 10% will go to those other Olympic sports. But I do think people have to understand, because it's almost a misnomer that you think all, even P4 programs operate in the black, and they just don't. It doesn't work like that. You only got about 20 schools that actually operate of the probably 300 D1, I'm talking just D1, who operate in the black. Everybody else is getting subsidized at some percentage. So you're having to make up additional dollars that you don't already have and constitute that as real money. Give you some information. So 35% of athletic programs receive anywhere from 10 to 49% of financial support from the university. 40% of athletic departments get about 50% or higher of their budget from the universities. When you start looking at that, and I'm talking to, these are, you know, your P4 programs, top, you know, 65 set programs, they're getting subsidized at some percentage outside of those maybe 15 or 20 schools. And so you're having to generate additional dollars. Like New Mexico State, we have like what I would consider revenue streams. We don't necessarily have generating revenue. We don't have rivers like that, right? Because, you know, when you look at our operation, our ticket sales, right, that's one thing you got to look at. When you also look at the TV contracts, that's where a lot of the dollars come from. Donors, the level of donors you have. We don't have a Cody Campbell at Texas Tech at a $4 billion clip right there. Your institutional support is what you're going to rely on, student fees, and then your licenses and royalties. But the two big ticket items are your television broadcasting rights and ticket sales. And if you're filling up the stadium, your television broadcast rights, that's what's generating that. And I'll add this note, let me maybe talk about it a little bit more in length, but you always ask, why is this so important to the U.S. economy? Well, because U.S. sports industry generates over $150 billion, would it be billion dollars? And okay, so that's impacting the gross national product some way, somehow, right? I don't know what percentage it is, but $150 billion annual is a lot of money. And so college athletics, number one, is wrapped up into that to the tune of about $15 billion. And here's the other piece that a lot of people have to look at when you look at the U.S. economy And when it comes to sports, it's woven into the American fabric. You got 8 million high school athletes wanting to fulfill that dream. Not all of them, right? And you got 500,000 college athletes. We have the only system on the 7 continents that focus on college athletics at the level that we do.
So I think we've kind of touched on everything NIL. Probably the most important thing that I want to know about NIL is, what would I have been worth back in the day? Coming out of high school, top 2 in the United States. Come on, what would you have given me?
Wow, and the fact that you were also high maintenance when you came out. You just really wanted the best of the best. You know, I don't know if Iowa State would have been able to afford you back then. I probably would have cut him a deal for myself personally. But I think because I want to say I was one of your hosts when you came on the visit. Again, we're talking 35 years ago, so I'd have to go back to my memory bank. But I think I could have convinced you to come down a little bit. But track-wise, I think you would have been very happy. And it could have been upwards, and I'm not exaggerating. It could have been upwards to 6 figures. I don't think there's any question today that your high-end track and field athletes are at that level.
Okay, well, I'm going to go back and ask for that if that's I don't know if that's possible or not. So, okay, I believe we've kind of touched on everything NIL. Let's talk about the new NCAA regs. I think that's important for people to understand. The recruiting world is forever changed, unquestionable. I know you've referenced, since COVID, forget about everything before that. Let's get into that.
Sure. You know, and I tell most parents this, if you don't hear anything else I say, understand this. Anything you knew, understood, and appreciated pre-COVID, just throw that out the window from a recruiting standpoint, because it is not it's not even attainable. It's not even in the same ballpark of how recruiting 101 works today. It's not relevant. The transfer portal has taken over tremendously. I think it was the number that I saw was 20,000 NCAA athletes have entered the transfer portal in 2024-25 alone. Okay, that's an enormous increase to what it was. It may have been a couple through 3,500 total pre-COVID. Right now you're jumping up to 20,000 on that end. So if your son or daughter is coming out of high school, they have to understand that there may have to be other options, because James Hall is already at University X as a junior, and he has just elevated his stock. And now he wasn't a hot commodity at one of these P4s, and now he is. And so now you, Scott, the son, was going to go to that university, but now they got a chance to get James. And guess what? James has been on college campus for 3 years. He's traveled for 3 years. He's played in games for 3 years. He's done academics for 3 years. He's done practice for 3 years. He's lifted. He understands sports medicine, sports performance, the academic, all this, the student development pieces, right? The social responsibility. He's a good academic student. I'm taking James over Scott. That's just what it's going to work, because James is going to be plug and play versus Scott, who's got to learn all of those variables when he gets to a college campus.
Yeah, and I think one thing that parents and athletes don't understand is you're no longer competing against other high school kids for that college spot. You are competing with the high school kids, but you've got JUCO, you've got transfer portal, you got foreigners in every sport now. And it's just the way you looked at it 10 years ago, you have to look at alternative routes now to either going into JUCO, going to the NAI level, or starting at a lower level. Talk a little bit about coaches and how they are looking at high school athletes now, particularly from the Division I and Division II levels.
Sure. The developmental programs that existed COVID, again, are almost non-existent right now. When you would bring a freshman in and allow him and her to really kind of build themselves mentally, physically, and even spiritually to some degree, and then they'd be ready to play the game at the higher level the following year. Well, that's almost non-existence, where you might have saved, let's say, 4 scholarships for freshmen for basketball. Now that's 1. Okay, that's dropped down from 100% of 4 to 25%. And so you're looking at that. Football's the same way. Individuals who are now coming out of high school have to realize that at one point you were on the expressway and you were rolling. Well, you might have to take that service road now. Still going to get you there, right? It's not as fast, but you're still going in the right direction, and that might be a better alternative for you. And then you can always get back on the expressway, right? But you have to understand that that may be a viable option. That may be your best option, the Division II, Division III, because here in the NAIA and the junior college, because they're recruiting from everywhere now. At one point, recruiting someone from a lower division was just a faux pas. It was a no-no. You did not do that because you looked bad from not being able to recruit. Now, hey, and maybe the kid got over-recruited, and we'll take him because if he can perform, get him in there. If she's our number one choice, let's get her. And no one has anything else to say but good job nowadays. And so you still have the option to do that, and you need to look at that and not turn your nose up at it.
So I know when I was coming out, one of the cool things was recruiting trips. When you had these colleges talking to you, and I think I did Iowa State, Nebraska, LSU, Florida, and Georgia, I believe, were mine. You had got your five trips. I don't even know if that's the way it was anymore. That was such like an honor to be able to go and do that. And they took Kerry and they took you out to dinner and all those things. How has that changed?
For your recruiting cycle, you have to understand where things are at. And you have to meet the new prospect where he or she is currently at. And what I mean by that, I know student athletes are requesting to be paid to make a trip because now they've got to make some decisions on that end. And that's permissible in terms of kind of if you want to make that part of an NIL deal, then you go ahead and make that part of the agreement or condition and you kind of go from there. That's where the difference lies, number one. I think number two, when student athletes, prospects, and even transfers are no longer looking at programs like they used to for their high academic esteem. And what I mean by that, you may want to go in and I'm being kinesiology and this University Y has a great kinesiology program. Well, if you're transferring two and three times, you're not meeting the academic benchmarks that you need to remain eligible. So kinesiology may no longer be an option. So you may have to, you know, pivot and go to arts and science and go to communication journalism. You may go business, kind of depending on where you lie. And so that's where you're seeing a shift in the academic majors that they're choosing. But I also want people to understand they are still making academic progress towards graduation. They still have a higher graduation rate than most general students on their particular campuses. That's the one thing that has remained the same. And the graduation rates for student athletes around the country is about 90%. It's different in the sense of what you talked about, taking trips now. Instead of taking a recruiting trip, you're taking a business trip.
Right. So I had a conversation a couple of weeks ago, called a Division I coach for one of my athletes, track and field. And I just asked him, I said, how are these roster limitations affecting you? And I can't repeat what he said to me because he's not very happy about it. But he, this is a smaller D1. He said, typically they would carry 70 to 80 females on their college track and field roster. He said, by next year, they have to be down to 45, and 18 of those have to be cross-country runners. So you're basically, you've got about 20-some spots for the rest of your events in track and field. He said, look, I've got a family. I have young kids. I want to spend time with my family. He said, every time I go to the transfer portal, or I go to the islands he mentioned, which a lot of track and field do. He said, it creates issues. You know, it takes my time to deal with these people outside of track and field. He said, I just don't want to do it. So I'm trying to recruit from the Midwest, essentially. He said it's made his life so much more difficult. Are you seeing that in all the sports?
Absolutely. There's no question. The evolution and transformation of college athletics is turned upside down. So I certainly feel his pain because while you think roster limits help you, it doesn't in the sense that unless you have the dollars to fill those additional scholarships that are now granted, it does you no good. You're actually going to have to pull back on your roster because what those equivalency scholarships, what that means that when you and I in school, that I could be on room, Brett Kearney could be on books, and then you could be on tuition and fees. That's one scholarship for three people. Well, now those scholarships have to go to that one person. And that's why he's saying, yeah, it's great to have more people, but now every scholarship is a full athletic scholarship. And so that's really, I think, what's going to not only hurt the college rank, but it's also hurting the Olympic sports and the U.S. Olympics, because unless we figure out a way to help maintain our U.S. Olympics through college and collegiate structure, we're going to have to do like other countries and almost be developmental, where those individuals are doing nothing but actually participating in their respective sport. And they go to college after the Olympics, right? They're full-time athletes, even after the high school level. So those are some of the things that we will look at too. And so I can understand where the coach is coming from in terms of some of the limitations that he's now up against.
That said, do you see an increase in organizations like IHG Academy or Spire Academy, where kids are going there instead for that developmental piece? Now, I mean, obviously the biggest part is not everybody's got 70 grand to drop every year to go, you know, reside at one of those facilities and train every day. Do you see anything like that transpiring or changing?
No, I do. I see that. I mean, you can see it in Iowa. I forgot what it's called, but the basketball academy that they have there, and it's grown, and you're getting top talent to come. And so you're getting folks and investors and millionaires and billionaires to, you know, really commit to those type of academies so that they can now move to the next level, whether they can go from, you know, that academy, they can go to the NBA or G League, or they can go even overseas or wait and go to college and then go to NBA later. I mean, you're seeing those open up. I can see that in track and field. I can certainly see that in gymnastics and some other elements. So to answer your question, yes, I can definitely see the academies really beginning to expand to help offset what's going on in college athletics.
Interesting. And I'm learning about this at home as well, because my oldest daughter, she was a Division I track athlete. You know, she got a little bit of money to go to school. She was a state place winner. She won some state titles in relay events. She was a great basketball and volleyball player, and kind of went through the old school recruiting. Now I've got a daughter that's a junior, who is a talented volleyball player, talented high jumper. You know, you put the highlight reel together, you reach out to colleges, and the feedback I've gotten is, how high can she touch? That's the only metric they care about. We've been told by recruiters that they're not even going to watch the film until she can meet the metrics. And so it seems like recruiting now is just way more cut and dry. You better fit into this box athletically, and then we'll look at your film and we'll see what your attitude's like and how you work with your teammates. But it's getting the foot in the door seems to be so much more difficult now.
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it is all about measurables and metrics. I mean, that's what it's going to, right? I mean, do they meet those kind of standards? It was like track, right? Track and field was different. I mean, you knew you were good based on your stopwatch. You knew you were good by the height that you made. I mean, so there was no arguing how good you were or were not. Right now, you're starting to see that into the other sports. It's all about the measurables and the metrics that you put forth to determine if you are a tier one prospect, are you a tier two prospect? And I don't care how good of a student you are, it helps, but it's not going to make a difference on whether they choose you over somebody else because you're a good academic person. Because again, they need to see those measurables transfer to the field, to the court, to the track, to the pool, to the respective sport.
So again, I mean, everything's different. I don't see how you walk this back. The one thing I can say from my side of it, you better find yourself a good sports performance coach, because the way things are now, where you're a high school senior trying to compete with 23-year-old men and women, you better do everything you can to reach your genetic ceiling, because that's who you're competing against now. And I don't know that learning curve has been realized yet. I still think a lot of parents and athletes think it's the same as it always has been. Your approach has to change now. It cannot be, my football team, we get in the weight room a couple times. No, you need to be training as if your life depends on it, because your college future does. And you know, that's obviously my side of the business, trying to educate people how important it is. But I mean, would you agree with that statement?
Absolutely, 1,001%. I mean, you're just going to have to, I hate to say it, but you're just going to have to be more sports specific in where you're at, because you're going to have to make sure, again, you're hitting those marks from a measurable and a metric standpoint, right? And so you're going to have to be bigger, stronger, faster, because you are going up against folks that are 4, 5, and sometimes 6 years older than you. And that makes a huge difference. And so you've got to be specific, you know, in terms of, I mean, I was telling my daughter the other day, is like, some people just don't understand. You cannot teach speed. You can become faster based on technique, okay, and based on skill set and different elements and angles. But speed is speed, right? And you got to understand that you can help them get faster, but it's not going to be because you either got fast twitch muscles or you don't, okay? And then what we're going to do is help work the tendons, work the ligaments, work the muscles, get to your bones, get to your genetic ceiling, all of those things that are going to be tested. So we make sure that, like you said, you maximize that. And the only way you can do it, unfortunately, is get that sports performance coach, because these individuals are going to, from university to university, they're turning that around in 9 months, 18 months. So, and if you don't have the same ability, the same access, the same tools, the same technology, the same science, your performance is not going to be where you'd like it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. My interview last week was with a professional baseball player, and he came to me during COVID because his season got shut down, and he was big, he was strong, he could move a lot of weight. He said, "I just don't feel fast or explosive." And I got him out on the track with our Division I track athletes, and before I knew it, he was beating them. He goes on to Louisville, goes to the MLB Combine, and runs the second fastest 30-yard dash. And I drilled him and taught him as he was a track athlete, and he made a really good comment: speed doesn't kill, speed pays. Because yes, he got drafted in the fourth round by the Yankees, and he probably dropped, you know, 0.3 off of his 60-yard dash time. It pays. So I just can't emphasize that part enough, that if you are a high school athlete and you are not with somebody that is progressing you, not just in the weight room, but getting faster, jumping higher, being more explosive, changing directions better, you are putting yourself far behind what's out there and that you're competing against. James, what is your prediction over the next 10 years? What does the NCAA landscape as far as the conferences look like?
You know, what I would have to say, Scott, is here's what I predict. I predict, and I think it'll happen sooner than later, the CBS NCAA TV contract, I think, is up in 2032. It may even be a little bit before that. But I think before that, and I think sooner than later, that I think you're going to have a super league where the top 65, 70, maybe 75 schools are going to break off. They're going to govern themselves. They're going to begin to stay within that confines. I mean, they're going to be playing each other, and the likes of New Mexico State and game guarantees are going to be fewer and farther apart. And then now the group of fives are going to get together, and we're going to start making a decision that what's going to be best for us from a conference realignment standpoint. And you probably get some FCS schools there, as well as maybe some D2s. And now you start structuring your conference around an 8 to 10 hour radius, right? So that means you save your Olympic sports on the biggest ticket item, which is travel. So now, instead of having to fly to Atlanta, you can just go 8 hours up the street, do your contest, and drive back. Now, you may get back 2, 3 in the morning, but now you haven't stayed that extra day. You're back home, and now your travel budget is down. I think that's what's going to save the Olympic sports, is that separation from the top 75 schools, and then reconfiguring conference realignment for your Olympic sports moving forward. I think the NIL and things will eventually flatten out. I think those numbers will begin to decrease as you see that structure.
And so, James, for families, for parents listening, where is kind of the go-to resource where they can learn?
Well, you know what? The biggest thing is you have to continue to do something that I didn't do very well in high school. I got better at it at college, and even I started my PhD at Ohio State, but that is to do your homework. There is way too much information out there for you not to be able to inform yourself, to be able to do the one thing, ask questions. The internet is the best place to go. The NCAA.org, you get, and then the specific conferences and schools. You start doing that, putting that together. Obviously, I do that externally for people who reach out and want to have more information about how, what direction they need to go based on where they're at. There's individuals like yourself and myself that can help those individuals independently, but there's enough information out there where you can just Google, you can, hey, here's where I'm at. You plug that in, it gives you some information, and then now you have the ability to start going asking questions.
Great information. Well, James, I sure appreciate you spending time with me. Always good to see your face and to talk with you. But you're extremely educated and have a lot of experience in all these areas. You know, I think that's what parents and athletes and coaches need to hear. So thank you again for being on the show. And I'm sure we can probably do this again sometime. All right. Thanks for joining Building the Athlete today. Great interview with James Hall, Deputy Athletic Director at New Mexico State. We covered a lot of information, great information for parents and athletes on NIL money, NCAA regs, new roster limitations. The world has changed in recruiting forever. I don't think there's a way that this will ever be walked back. We have to adapt. We have to adapt as athletes, as parents, as coaches, and we have to go out there and learn how to get to, you know, what is your pathway now? The one thing that James commented on is the plug and play. You got to be ready to go as a high school senior. If you can't contribute to that school, they are not going to look at you. So that's where sports performance comes in. You have to have your body as close to your genetic potential as possible. And that's only going to happen if you find yourself a high-level sports performance coach. They are all over, but you got to do your research. You got to find somebody that has proven that they can develop athletes. At Benson Sports Training, we have developed over 400 professional and NCAA athletes. We have trained thousands and thousands of athletes. BensonSportsTraining.com, great place to start. Free consultation, pop-up screen right there on the homepage. If you want to talk about recruiting, if you want to talk about nutrition, recovery, training, speed, strength, whatever it is, hit me up on BensonSportsTraining.com or any of our socials, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook. Thanks for joining us today, and we will see you next week.